Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lauffel, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today we have a great guest. Of course, I am talking about General Glenn Van Herk, who was most recently the commander of U.S. Northern Command, and he's now the principal at Glenn Van Herk Advisors. Of course, he's retired, and he's enjoying life on the opposite side of the state of Missouri from me. I'm holding down the West, and he's holding down the East. And, I thought this, he and I have talked periodically over the last few years on different topics. And, you know, having been the NORTHCOM commander, he's had a lot of opportunity to see and experience the threats that are facing the United States. And as opposed to a geographic combatant command in Asia or Europe, thinking about defending the homeland, which was his job, gives you a different perspective. And of course, I wanted to have him on NucleCast to share that perspective and nearly 40 years of experience and wisdom from the Air Force as a, you know, he flew bombers, flew them all over the country and all over the world. And so, Glenn, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Well, thanks, Adam. It's an honor to be here with you. I look forward to talking about various topics, including threats. I'd remind everybody that NORTHCOM does have a nuclear role as the backup to STRATCOM. I did have a deep nuclear background, as you mentioned, with flying bombers as well. So deterrence is a passion for me. As the NORTHCOM commander, I thought differently about deterrence, not cost imposition deterrence oftentimes, but deterrence by denial, that missile defense, the resilience. So we can talk about that, and I think that's really important.
So you mentioned deterrence by denial, and sort of rather as the NORTHCOM commander, you were tasked with deterring attack on the U.S. and defending the homeland, as opposed to taking the fight to adversaries. So tell us how that shapes and makes you, the way you think about deterrence different from perhaps, you know, the UCOM commander or the, you know, the STRATCOM commander.
Well, the first thing I would tell you, Adam, is I'm a firm believer that the nuclear deterrent is the foundation of homeland defense. And our nuclear triad has been what's kept great powers from going to war for years. But our great powers out there have figured out that they can operate below that nuclear threshold and threaten our homeland. And that's eroding strategic stability. You know, attacks on our homeland, whether that's a cyber attack or attack within space on our equities in space, is going to destabilize us globally in our homeland. The way I thought about it first was detection of threats. You have to have the domain awareness to deter or defeat any threats to our homeland. If you can demonstrate the ability on a day-to-day basis to have the domain awareness of what's potentially threatening you across all domains, and that starts in land, air, space, maritime, cyberspace, undersea, everywhere, that's crucial to deterrence overall, to be able to, for me as an operational commander, position forces or message through my messaging means or message through the Secretary of Defense, other combatant commanders, or the president, just by picking up the phone and say, we see you, we see what's going on. The other thing that I thought about, which I think is significant, is our resilience in our homeland, our ability to take a punch in the nose and get back up swinging. If you demonstrate that every single day, as part of a campaign plan, and you message that, and you do that not only as a military, but all of our critical infrastructure across our various sectors to include energy, transportation, finance, you name it, you will show any potential adversary that They cannot bring us to our knees in a time of crisis. And I think that's really, really important in their mindset, whether they're going to take an action, whether that's going to be on our homeland or somewhere forward. So, for example, you know, 80% of our force flow to fight a fight, either east or west, comes out of the homeland. If you show that they cannot bring that force flow to a stop or slow it down, that has a significant effect on their mental ability to make a decision that, yes, they want to take that action. So that's how I thought about it overall, and that was a primary focus of our strategy.
So you mentioned force flow, and that sort of leads me to wonder about TRANSCOM and the cyber threat. Because, you know, as I think about any potential conflict with Russia or China, I would anticipate that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that conflict is going to begin where our adversaries try to make us deaf, dumb, and blind. You know, and TRANSCOM and our ability to project forces would be one of those lucrative targets. And the cyber threat, I would think, would be particularly significant in attacks on TRANSCOM. So as you thought about deterrence by denial and deterrence writ large, how did you think about cyber and space and our ability to see, hear, and move?
Yeah, so I'm on record of saying I'm most concerned about the cyber threat and what we don't know about our critical vulnerabilities for critical infrastructure, that power projection that we talked about. So it's critical to get a look at where we may be vulnerable in the cyber domain for our partners that we rely on, that 80% that's outside of federal control, whether that be in seaports, airports, that we're going to project power from to understand, you know, how vulnerable that is, and to get those partners or stakeholders, if you will, to comply with cyber basic hygiene, to defend themselves on a day-to-day basis, to ensure that we're ready to go. I would tell you that I don't worry necessarily about the cyber threat of the future. I say that we're under attack today in the cyber domain and the information space. You know, our potential adversaries are planting the precursors in critical infrastructure right now so that they can delay and disrupt that force flow, and probably most importantly, destroy our will in a time of crisis to fight. What we have to do is come together as all stakeholders to ensure that we're as ready as we can be, that we're as resilient as we can be, whether that's in cyber or in space. I would say the most likely supported commanders in a fight in the Pacific or even in Europe are not going to be first the Indo-PACOM commander or the EUCOM commander. It's likely a compilation of multiple commanders that include CyberCom, SpaceCom, TRANSCOM, STRATCOM, and NORTHCOM, along with those other commanders.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So as you thought about, I mean, you identify the threat, you're worried about the threat. So then what is the ability of a NORTHCOM commander to do something about that threat, particularly with cyber, where we control so little of, you know, of that space, of that domain?
Yeah, well, that's a challenge. And I'm on record expressing my concerns about domain awareness. You know, you can't deter and defeat something you can't see. And so there are significant challenges for domain awareness in defending our homeland. And don't think about homeland threats start in our homeland. I'm talking global domain awareness, the ability to see further away from our homeland than we do today, to collaborate with fellow combatant commanders and allies and partners on a day-to-day basis to generate those effects. I would not want to be defending here in the homeland as the first order. I would want to generate those effects forward with a fellow combatant commander so that we're not having to do that here. But to do that, you have to have the domain awareness. And so I've expressed that concern. The NORTHCOM commander competes with every other combatant commander for resources. And so the NORTHCOM commander does not have assigned and allocated forces to execute in a time of crisis. That should concern us all. So in a time of crisis, when the NORTHCOM commander comes in, along with the STRATCOM commander, and you start asking for forces for the homeland, those forces have to come from somewhere, and they're likely going to come from somebody else's operational plan that they're trying to execute. And we would be adjudicating those things in a time of crisis. We've got to think differently, Adam, about how we do that, and so that we're not competing for the same resources in a time of crisis. And there's ways to do that through global force management and other means. Along with that, we need to think about how are we going to put forces in our homeland to provide that support should there be attacks on our critical infrastructure that likely Homeland Security, FEMA, and others are going to require just to maintain and sustain our way of life and power project out of our homeland. Those forces aren't accounted for either today. And so if, you know, we saw during the attack on our pipeline, and I don't remember the name of that right now, but when it almost brought the East Coast to a halt, there was going to be a significant demand on the Department of Defense to ensure fuel flow kept flowing to the East Coast. Those are things we must think about on a day-to-day basis and make sure we're ready for any potential crisis.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's one of those things that, as we think about Russia and China, we're often thinking, you know, much like we as Americans do, we think about conflict over there. We often tend not to think about the possibility that conflict will be brought back to our own continent and our own country. And so oftentimes we leave these really important things sort of undiscussed, and, you know, we're often unconcerned about them, to our own detriment, of course. So one of the things that's, of course, as you know, it's become popular, is a, you know, a point of movement right now, is the idea that we're going to build, you know, the Golden Dome. We're going to build a, you know, the return of SDI, whatever folks may want to call it. Missile defense is sort of back in vogue, and there's a lot of movement in that direction. And you mentioned early on that missile defense and defending the homeland was critically important. What's your take on missile defenses? You've looked at it, you're familiar with it, you've had to, you know, make it an operational capability. How do you see it? How do you think about it?
You know, I think the most strategic mission I had as the commander of NORTHCOM and NORAD, so two separate commands, was threat warning and attack assessment, okay, for strategic deterrence purposes. And so as we think about Golden Dome and potential threats, we can't forget that the most important thing is understanding where those threats are, who's threatened, that we survive our continuity of our government, that we survive and ensure a second assured strike from our nuclear forces as well. And so I think as we build out any Golden Dome, that needs to be priority one. I was very happy to hear the Trump administration first talk about Iron Dome. I wish they wouldn't have called it Iron Dome, but they did. Iron Dome is mortars and rockets, but I understand where the president was going, and now he's talked about Golden Dome. So I think it's an opportunity for us to think differently about how we're going to defend our homeland. What I see happening, though, is nobody really understands at this point what Golden Dome is. There's no, you know, OV1 or concept for everybody to understand. And so I think it would be important that the department come out with what that is, or any contractors that are moving forward, of what it is. And I think Golden Dome has to be a multi-layered approach to defense of our homeland, not just against ballistic missiles. We can defend against those today, but against hypersonic missiles that emanate from space, that emanate from ballistic missile, you know, rocket launchers, that may come off of ships, that may come off of airplanes, they may come off of land, they may come off of submarines. Those are things that are important. Also, cruise missiles that have been there forever, which can come off of multi-platforms. And how about drones and UAS, which as well can come off of multiple platforms. And then there's the asymmetric threats that could be utilized out of container ships, which may launch a cruise missile or a hypersonic. So as we look at this, and I wrote an op-ed on this that was in the National Interest asking for a fresh look at Homeland Defense. I think we need a layered approach against multiple threats, and that all starts with policy. What are we going to defend? What pieces of critical infrastructure? From who? And from what threats? I think it's unaffordable and unachievable to defend from everything and all threats. For example, you're not going to defend from 3,000 nuclear missiles coming from both Russia and China. So what is the right number to defend against to create a deterrent effect? Same thing for hypersonics, etc. But all of this needs to be brought together from a policy perspective before you can really develop a plan, resource that plan, and move forward. And I think that's where the department is right now. They're getting ready to take their plan to the president. I believe you'll see a three-dome plan, which is a dome that starts with the domain awareness dome, a space dome, and then a air dome, if you will. Within those domes, threats can come from multiple places, but eventually most of them end up in space or air. And so I think that's where you'll see things go forward.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion lately in terms of, you know, this Russian nukes in space that we've heard about that may or may not be quite what we think it is. Or there's been discussion, you know, that us putting defensive capabilities in space don't violate, you know, the Outer Space Treaty. Have you thought through sort of what we might need to do in space and you know, what you put in space? Do you put kinetic capabilities? Is it merely, you know, warning and assessment? What's your take on how we utilize space?
So the first thing I would say is I think defending against hypersonics and defending against more ballistic missiles in the near term, I'm saying 3 to 5 years as you field it, is going to be terrestrial-based until we can transition likely to a space-based capability, but that will be policy-dependent. I do think the future is in space. I think space can be affordable. The types of weapons that you put in space, whether they're kinetic, bullets shooting bullets, or whether they're the use of directed energy, that's TBD, I think, based on technology and affordability as we go forward. But a lot of people will say, you know, we shouldn't weaponize space. What I would tell you is our adversaries have already weaponized space, and all we're doing is putting ourselves at a deficit or disadvantage if we don't counter or defend our national security assets in space. We have to do that. So I think the future does take us to space.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fair point. Now it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. So we'll do that and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrent Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back and we're talking to General Glenn Van Herk, who was formerly the NORTHCOM commander. And we've been talking about his perspective as, you know, the NORTHCOM commander on deterrence and related issues. So let me ask you, what is that thing or that topic that perhaps when you were in other roles that you didn't think about a lot? And then after sitting in the chair as the NORTHCOM commander, you were surprised at how important, you know, that issue or that capability was, and you kind of wish you would have known more about it years before. What was that, or was there not one?
Yeah, I can't say there's one thing, Adam. What I would tell you is when you get in the chair, you realize how valuable relationships that you've established are, trust that you've established, that our allies and partners are critical to our success globally, and they need to be part of our decision and thought process and strategies as we develop deterrence strategies. They are crucial to us. And so, you know, we were talking about Golden Dome before you took the break. I would think that we should look at Do we bring Canada into missile defense? They've oftentimes stood back and looked at that and not partaken, if you will, in missile defense. I think we have an opportunity. We should bring them in. Just as we should bring Canada in, we should look at other partners around the globe for how we're going to create strategic stability through the ability to defend our interests globally and our allies and partners globally. That, I think, was something that I probably didn't fully understand, that how those relationships, how crucial they would be.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of those things that, you know, relationships, you sort of value them once you don't have them, or, you know, you realize how important they were later on. So as you think back on this, 40-year career where you flew, the Air Force's best aircraft, its most advanced aircraft, and you sort of look out at threats in the future, do you think the Air Force is moving? Are we buying the right stuff? Are we buying, particularly for deterrence? Do we need to relook at how we field a deterrent force? What's your take on that?
I think we're a little bit out of balance with regards to long-range strike and fighter platforms to generate a deterrent effect. And if we have to fight to win, and by that, let me just kind of explain. So agile combat employment, operating within the, second island chain, potentially first island chain, will require huge logistics, will require huge tanker demand. Anything that we can do to reduce the demand on tankers, which, remember earlier I talked about, STRATCOM is going to compete for those same tankers. NORTHCOM will compete. INDOPACOM will be competing for them. There's just not enough. Anything we can do to reduce the demand on logistics in the tanker and put it where you can potentially fly longer duration, longer sorties to generate deterrent effects, or just deter because you can do it as a matter of fact, I think will be crucial. So I think the Air Force should go rebalance the portfolio, probably maintain the fighter, but I would increase the future buy on long-range strike. And that doesn't necessarily mean it has to be an air-based platform, Adam. And so long-range strike can come from mobile land platforms that are survivable, or off of naval vessels. It could come from space-based capabilities. These are all things that we need to think about to ensure that we're able to generate the effects that we need to effect. What I would tell you is we should demand more of allies and partners to help us in this space also, and I think they're willing to do that, but I think it'd be a great opportunity to ask them to do more.
So when you say do more, is this more defense spending? Is it more, expansion of their own capabilities? Is it, support for U.S. forces forward? Explain what you mean by that.
Well, where we have gaps to build out capacity right now, whether that's in shipbuilding to generate long-range strike, whether it's in, bombers, we should ask them to step in and fill that role. So there may be opportunities for us to provide, long-range strike capabilities, or other nations who have the industrial capacity to produce it that can basically help us fill a gap for long-range strike today. I think long-range strike is going to be a gap for a while just because of the capacity to produce it.
Yeah, it's interesting. You probably, I would imagine, don't remember, but in about a decade or so ago, I looked for on behalf of the chief of staff. He had a task for me, and it was to prioritize the Air Force's core functions, because at that time we had about 13 of them, and there was disagreement on what was most important. And so as I finished this study and turned it in, and my take was that long range strike is sort of the core of what the Air Force does. It's the most important thing. It's why it's the raison d'etre of the Air Force. It's why we exist, is long range strike. But that it didn't necessarily resonate beyond me and a few other folks. And so I wonder, for the Air Force and looking at what it's going to buy in the future, we're going to get the, you know, the F-47, and we're, you know, we've got F-35s, and that was sort of, you probably remember back in the day, that was a debatable aircraft. Why do you think the Air Force, and this is sort of a great segue into your discussion, why do you think the Air Force has not focused on a larger long-range strike capability? You know, if we take what we had in 1992, you know, we had 300-plus bombers on alert, and now, you know, we've got less than 100 total. So what's been that shift in focus?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First, you know, in the early 90s, when the Soviet Union went away, the peace dividend broke out. And then shortly thereafter, we had Saddam invade Kuwait. And we found ourselves in a more than three-decade fight. And then we were attacked in our homeland. That led to a fight of a different kind with a different platform and less focus on strategic deterrence and less focus on long-range strike. During that period, potential adversaries adapted their capabilities to, after watching our way of war, especially during OIF, and they've adapted their capabilities. And so we took and built a force for a European and a Central Command Middle Eastern fight with smaller aircraft, more agile aircraft to operate in that environment where you didn't necessarily need longer range strike. Today, we still need to be able to do that. And you're looking at a guy who's, you know, started out as a fighter pilot, okay? And I value that greatly. But the problem is vastly different in the Pacific than it is in the Middle East or in Europe. And so what we're trying to do right now in the Pacific is jam a force structure, not only an Air Force force structure, but a Joint Force structure into a AOR. We're trying to fit that into our strategy rather than building a entirely new force structure to fight that fight. And if I had it to do my way, long-range strike across the Joint Force would free up tankers, would free up the logistics network, which is going to be vulnerable, by the way. And by the way, you win fights through logistics, okay? If you don't have fuel, if you don't have ammo, you don't have pieces and parts, you're not going to win. And that's a challenge in the Pacific.
Yeah. Now, it's that time in the show where I like to bring out Bob the Genie. And so as I rub my magic lamp, Bob, of course, grants all NucleCast guests three wishes. He only stipulates that they have to be about the topics we've been discussing. So let me ask you, Glenn, what is your first wish?
I'd like to see a more agile acquisition process within the department, that we can go faster to fill the capabilities that we need today. Right now, our requirements process essentially defines the gadget that needs to be built. What we need to be building is, doing is having requirements that actually allow for innovation. That would be my first one.
Yeah, that's 100%. That's what we used to do. We don't anymore, though. So that's a great wish. I'm sure Bob will be on it. Okay, second wish then.
I wish that Congress would work closely across the government to make the budget process fit today's environment, which is data and software driven. The budget process we have is good for buying planes, tanks, ships, and those kinds of things. It's not agile enough to operate in software driven technology and capability that changes within 2 to 6 weeks. And we need to be able to operate in that timeline. So the budget process needs a lot of work.
Do you think that there's any way for a government to really be able to operate, particularly in the cyber domain, like you mentioned, where we have the speed is so fast? I'm not sure that a government can really operate in even a smaller element of it at that kind of speed. Do you have any specific, you know, things that you saw and you said, man, this is how we need to make that happen?
Well, there's some innovative companies. There's some innovative places within the department, but culturally across our government, culturally within the department, that's just not where we are. And Congress is risk averse. And so Congress has to be part of the solution. They have to be able to accept risk and failure, but maintain their oversight role and response. And so I don't have a specific example for you, but I would tell you, we've got to do better than we are doing today.
Yeah, it seems like if you were to go back to that period in the 1950s when we were, you know, building the ICBM and developing it, and we had lots of failure over a period of years in the 50s. I don't know that we would ever replicate that today, because we would never allow ourselves to do things that failed repeatedly. Because like you said, we would be too risk averse, and Congress would say, hey, look at all the money we're throwing away, as opposed to seeing that failure as growth and advancement. Yeah, so that's another one. Okay, so your final wish, one last wish.
Well, I would wish that we would embrace a data and information environment and see the value of utilizing the tools that are available to us today through artificial intelligence and machine learning. You know, there's incredible opportunity there to gain efficiency, effectiveness as we move forward. We have to do that. I think that's crucial. If you're going to do that, then we see value in investing in the bright, shiny object that you can park on the ramp, or you can park, in the harbor or wherever. We have to invest in our foundational infrastructure, the IT infrastructure, the basic things that make us resilient and secure. And so if we could come together as a whole of nation and see that those things, those types of things, which aren't the bright, shiny object, but are incredibly valuable as we go down a path for combined joint command and control, those types of things, I would wish we could be able to do that.
All right. Those are three good wishes. I will make sure Bob gets on it. He's a genie who works for the betterment of the American people. So we'll have him get on it. So as we conclude the show, you know, is there, as you've had some time to decompress from your last job and you've sort of looked back and thought over your career, is there anything sort of pearls of wisdom or parting sort of wisdom that you'd want to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think the number one job of a leader is to grow more leaders, to empower those around you, provide them honest feedback, pat them on the back when they need it, kick them in the rear end when they need it. I think that's our number one job, is especially senior leaders. How important those relationships are absolutely matters. And understanding that trust, the value of that, is going to carry us as we go forward. Those are just a couple of them up front.
All right. Glenn Van Herk, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Frunkel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it, and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.